Chapter 2 To October 1920. The autumn sun, mellow and golden, shone into the dining room at Yarrow Hall Farm. Clarissa Bender poured herself a second cup of tea and edged her chair over until she could feel the sun on her face. The remains of family breakfast were on the table, and the scent of bacon still hung in the air. Leo, her husband, had already gone out about his business on the farm, and she'd sent the boys upstairs so that Mavanwy could get them ready for school. Clarissa savoured these few moments of tranquillity in the morning, using them to make her plans for the rest of the day. The crab apples were at their best, and it was a wonderful morning to go out and pick them. This afternoon she'd make the crab apple preserve Leo loved so much. It always gave her satisfaction to see her larder shelves fill up at this time of the year.
"I didn't realize for a long time just how domesticated you were," Leo had said with his wry laugh over breakfast. "Nobody else would hire a cook and then do all the cooking herself."
"Not all. Anyway, I enjoy it." She pulled a face. Mrs. Tatler, known as Tatty, described herself as a cook general and had plenty of other chores to take care of.
"You enjoy nursemaiding the children, too."
"Well, of course, I want to be with them as much as I can." Clarissa knew it was a necessity. 16-year-old Mavanwy acted as dairymaid as well as nanny. She had butter to make 3 times a week, milk to separate after each milking, and countless utensils to scald daily.
"You make sure Mavanwy isn't idle," he laughed again. "You organize us all."
"It's not hard."
"You're not doing too much."
"Of course not. Think of the economy. We manage with 1/4 of the servants your mother used to have." Clarissa wanted to bite out her tongue. She should never have used the word economy. It always wiped the smile from his face.
"If only you didn't have such big ideas about this house," he complained.
"Why not? Your family has lived in it for the last 50 years.
"And never quite managed to get it in good repair."
"I'm happy to do a lot of the work on it myself."
"You can't put a new roof on, Clarissa. And no, I can't get the farm workers to do it. We have neither the skills nor the time. Living in this house is a gross extravagance. It costs more to keep the rain out than it would to build a new one. If I had my way, we'd move to the dower house."
Clarissa pulled a face. The dower house had been built long enough ago to be draughty and inconvenient, yet not so long as to have the elegant proportions of the main house. Leo stirred his tea crossly.
"It's soundly constructed, and should be plenty big enough. Your friends are moving out today, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"I expect that's why you wanted them there in the first place. If they're renting it, we can't move in."
The other worry surfaced in Clarissa's mind.
"I suppose it is all right to let them leave the baby with Maisie O'Malley." "Between them and their conscience, I'd say. She's had 4 and 3 are still living. Not a bad average."
"Leo!"
"They're pushing some of the responsibility for it onto you, but I've no doubt you'll cope."
"I expect they'll come more often now, to see how the baby's getting on."
"I don't."
Leo pulled a wry face.
"Less often. They won't want to have anything to do with it. Easy to see that."
Clarissa frowned. "I can't imagine any mother handing her baby over, wanting it out of sight and hearing as soon as possible."
"That's what I mean. That girl won't come back. Probably won't want to see you in Birkenhead either. They'll all be afraid you'll let something drop, and her dark secret will be out."
Clarissa frowned again. Why hadn't that occurred to her before he'd suggested it?
"I shall miss Hannah if that happens." "Do think about the dower house, Clarissa. They had the whole place painted and papered in the spring. It won't look so good if it stays empty over the winter."
She shook her head, rushing to protest. "But I love it here. This is a wonderful, rambling old house. I couldn't bear to tear myself away." She had refurbished much of it with her own hands.
"I know, but it would be sensible. We'd have money for school fees and other things."
Leo had let the door bang behind him, shattering the domestic peace. Clarissa climbed the stairs slowly, pausing at a landing window. She loved to look out over Leo's kingdom. From here she could see for 20 miles over a patchwork of rolling fields and woods and streams on the lower slopes of the Clwydian range. It lay tranquil and beautiful in the morning sun. Behind the house, the land was wild and high, moorland and mountain. Leo's forebears had been yeoman farmers for generations, and when in the last century Yarrow came on the market, it seemed a prize but enhanced their status. His great-grandfather had struggled to buy it, and was fiercely determined it should stay in the family. To do this, and safeguard against its ever being split up, the house and estate were entailed on the eldest son in succeeding generations. Leo had inherited Yarrow Hall Farm, with 400 good acres. Like his father and grandfather, he was proud of it. He was a thrifty farmer, who saw the first drop in land values as an opportunity to expand. He now owned 500 acres, but land values had continued to fall, and his investment no longer seemed a wise one. Clarissa ran up the last flight of stairs. On the attic floor above the 6 bedrooms, there had always been a nursery, a playroom and schoolroom, as well as quarters for the servants. Leo didn't realize how much comfort all this space provided. She didn't keep the children confined up here. The boys were often out playing about the farm. In the nursery bathroom, M'Vanwy had just lifted baby Lucy from her bath, and at the same time was overseeing the boys as they cleaned their teeth. Clarissa took her towel-wrapped daughter from her and sat on the white wood chair to dry her. Perhaps Leo was right. Nothing short of gutting would improve this bathroom. The enamel had worn off the bath which had been installed when Queen Victoria was a girl. It was bitterly cold in winter, too, right up under the roof. To install central heating was out of the question. Even to mention any of this would only remind Leo that they needed to renew several window frames, as well as the dreaded roof. With the baby chuckling and rolling on the towel, Clarissa tried to see if there was any sign of a first tooth. She tickled one baby foot to make her open her mouth, and Lucy gave such a lovely throaty chuckle that Clarissa found herself doing it again for the pleasure of hearing her laugh. 4-year-old Nicholas came crowding close, his playful smile letting her know he wanted to join in the fun. She watched his chubby child's fingers running up the soles of the kicking baby feet until child and baby were bubbling over with chuckles, and she was laughing herself. How any mother could hire a nanny to do this and cut herself off from her own children, she couldn't understand. She snatched an opportunity to slide Lucy's vest over her head. Having M'Vanwy was quite different. It meant, as mother, Clarissa was still in control. She liked to have her children playing about her feet in the sitting room or kitchen, but if she wanted to concentrate on cooking or dressmaking, then there was somebody to take the children out for an airing. She hated to see them reach school age. She wanted to keep them with her, enjoying their company. School had come already for Jonathan and Hal. Usually she took them herself. "Hurry up," she told them. "It's time we were on our way." She hurried them downstairs, both dark-haired and serious, clutching their books, smart in their school uniforms. Nick tried to keep up. He liked to come along for the ride and pretend he too was going to school. Clarissa smiled when she saw he had a couple of old painting books tucked under his arm to mimic his older brothers. As a mother, she couldn't admit she had a favourite child, but she found Nicholas very endearing. He was unlike his older brothers, both in appearance and character. He was more sturdily built, with paler tow-coloured hair and freckles. Wide-eyed and innocent, and he chattered away non-stop. Leo said he couldn't keep himself away from the animals. Leo always saw that the pony was put between the shafts of the governor's cart and waiting for her. He was leading it round to the front door as she came out. "Think about it, Clarissa," he said, as he handed her the reins and lifted Nick in. "Have a good look round when you go to say goodbye to your friend. It's not a bad house. Good enough for the Mortimers, anyway." "Only in their hour of need," she answered tartly. Leo was smiling, trying to be gently persuasive.
Clarissa bit back the words. Hannah wouldn't want to spend the rest of her life there. She hated to hurt Leo's feelings, and knew he saw it as a personal failure that they had to count every penny. His father had died in 1916, and his mother had struggled to run the farm until Leo had returned from France. He'd taken it over at the end of the war, and farming incomes had fallen every year since. He was barely making enough to meet his family's needs. Why couldn't he understand that the pleasures of living in the gracious old house more than made up for the discomforts? But of course there was still the problem of school fees, a problem that would grow. It was a wonderful morning, mild and sunny, a good day for Hannah to travel home. Except that in a car, good weather wasn't so vital. Once Clarissa had been envious of Hannah. Marriage into the Mortimer family had seemed such incredible good fortune. "She'll be rich," she'd said to Leo. "No money worries for Hannah in the future." They'd all read newspaper articles about Sir Hugo's business exploits and huge gifts to the poor. "Sir Hugo's a legend in his own lifetime. Hannah says he speaks of Lloyd George and Bonner Law as though they were friends." "Perhaps they are. Can you see Hannah amongst the rich and high-born as a society hostess?"
"No."
"And it wouldn't suit you, Clarissa."
She was beginning to think the marriage didn't suit Hannah either. All summer she'd seen her wilting under the strain of coping with Dorothy. "The girl's bored stiff, that's her trouble," Clarissa had said. She tried to entertain them by taking them shopping and for rides in her pony and trap. She tried to interest the girl in sewing and knitting for the coming infant, but Dorothy disliked handicrafts. She'd failed to interest her in either cooking or gardening. Dorothy had refused to go for walks or even sit outside in the sun. She seemed permanently prickly with everybody. "What does she do with herself all day?" Clarissa had asked Hannah. "As little as possible. She says she reads." Clarissa had kept them both provided with books. One wet afternoon, Dorothy had played simple card games with Jonathan and Hal, and all had seemed to enjoy it. But the next time she'd taken the boys, Dorothy had been uninterested. She'd stopped taking Nicholas with her because Dorothy couldn't hide her dislike of the very young. She didn't like his endless questions, nor his habit of pushing storybooks on her knee and asking her to have one read. And she wouldn't stay in the same room for more than 5 minutes with baby Lucy. "If it hadn't been for you, Clarissa, I'd have gone out of my mind," Hannah had told her gratefully. "You're trying too hard. You'd feel better if you came up to the farm more and left her alone." Hannah gave a wry smile. "Daren't desert my post a second time. Anyway, it would be taking advantage of you. I shall keep trying." Only a few days before the baby had been born, she'd gone down to the Dower House to find Hannah in the garden, deheading dead roses in a frenzied state. "I thought I was better equipped to help Dorothy than anybody else. I wanted us to be friends, and thought this was my chance."
"What happened?"
"Clary, I've told her. I've said too much. It's a stupid thing I've done."
She'd caught at Hannah's waving hands to comfort her. "She'll understand."
"To think I half welcomed these months of waiting. I thought they'd bring us closer."
Clarissa had drawn Hannah to the seat under the apple tree and made her sit down. "When you married Matt, you said you were going to put your trouble behind you, forget the past."
"Said it, perhaps, but found I couldn't. Being with Dorothy has brought it all back. I told her I understood the grief and guilt she was living through. I thought it would help if we talked about it."
"Dorothy doesn't take things to heart as you do. What did she say?"
"I couldn't get through to her. Her mouth was set in that obstinate line."
Clarissa had put her own handkerchief in Hannah's hand and watched her scrub her eyes angrily.
"I told her of the awful regrets I'd had after parting with my own baby. How hardly a day goes by even now when I don't think of Alice, wondering how she's getting on and if she's happy. She'll be 13 next birthday."
Hannah's anguish was very moving. Surely it must have helped her to know she wasn't the only one.
Dorothy gave one of those wild laughs of hers. "You too, Hannah," she said. "I never dreamed my perfect mamma could have had the same fall from grace." She went on shaking with laughter. "I didn't intend to tell anyone but you, Clary."
"You did tell her that Matt doesn't know."
"Yes. Don't drop any hints to him," I said. "Please be on your guard. I've kept quiet too long to let him know now."
"And she promised?"
"Yes, but I'm still afraid. I thought we'd be closer if I told her. But we aren't, Clary. I'm scared she'll tell him."
Clarissa knew it had added another layer of tension when Hannah was already brimming over with anxiety over Dorothy's baby. But even before this summer, Hannah had not seemed as happy as she had expected. Every spring Clarissa went to spend a week with her at their house in Birkenhead. Though she looked forward to Hannah's company and the big shops, she thought the Mortimer's house less impressive than Yarrow Hall Farm, and there seemed a distance between Hannah and Matt she couldn't understand. This year her visit had been later, because the Mortimers had been away in Bath. Hannah had met her off the train, and nobody could have failed to notice her nerve-racked state. Hannah didn't think herself a beauty, and in the accepted sense perhaps she wasn't. Big-boned, with large dark eyes and a Roman nose. But her looks were striking. Taller than most women, she now dressed with plain elegance. In a crowd, she never went unnoticed. Clarissa remembered with awful clarity first hearing of Dorothy's plight. Hannah had asked for a tray of tea to be brought as soon as she'd got Clarissa into her sitting room.
"You've got to help me, Clary,"
she'd said as soon as the door closed behind the maid.
"Of course." Clarissa waited for more, but had to prompt. "Is it Matt?"
"No. Oh, God, it's a long story. It's Dorothy."
At that time it was a year since Clarissa had seen Dorothy. Then she'd been straight out of the schoolroom, a dainty girl with chocolate-box beauty, who always sat in the same chair in the drawing-room from where she could see her own reflection in a mirror. Clarissa had watched her preen, taking little interest in anything else. "She's a pretty girl, Hannah."
"And doesn't she know it? A selfish little madam."
There was a bitterness in Hannah's sharp criticism of her stepdaughter. "Her father spoils her, and as for her grandparents—" Clarissa had been a little taken aback.
"And she's pregnant," Hannah added.
The silence dragged out.
"Terrible for the Mortimers," managed Clarissa, knowing she gaped as though she didn't believe a word.
"They don't know, and they mustn't. Eunice does what she calls good work that can't be mentioned.
She belongs to a group that's trying to change men's behaviour, teach them more self-control. She's helping to uphold moral standards and stamp out prostitution. Matt is out of his mind with worry. He blames me, you see."
"Why should he?"
"He said it was my duty to see Dorothy was properly chaperoned."
Now Hannah was staring into space. Clarissa swallowed.
"How dreadful! How can I help?"
"We need a bolt hole. That house where your mother-in-law lived."
Clarissa relaxed. Nothing could be easier. They needed a tenant anyway.
"I'd love to have you living there, you know that. No problem."
"Nobody must know who we are."
Hannah's voice was urgent.
"And I've another favour to ask of you. We won't be able to bring the baby back here, not ever. Can you find a home for it? Perhaps one of your estate workers?"
"Farm workers. It's a farm, Hannah."
"Yes, well, I thought if you had a couple who couldn't have a child of their own and wanted—"
"We only have 3 cottages."
Clarissa knew she flushed. "That'll be the hardest part. One family is too old. We employ their sons."
"What about the other 2?
"They both have children. Leo says they're breeding like rabbits."
Hannah looked crestfallen. "There's an orphanage not far away."
"What do you suggest, that we abandon the baby on its doorstep?"
"Hannah!"
It was not like her friend to snap so sharply.
"We'd expect to pay to have the child fostered."
Look, you'll be on the spot yourself all summer. We'll see to that then. But you think it's possible? Might there be a family in your village? I don't know. Perhaps. I'll have to find somewhere. Clarissa saw Hannah shiver, then say in a rush of desperation, "We're all dreading it. Dorothy's scared stiff. I'll want to bring her to Yarrow before anything shows. Of course, the house is empty now. Any time." Curiosity drove her to ask, "The father?" Hannah sighed. "The Mortimers know the Tolmans. I didn't think they'd object to Lancelin." "But they did. Lady Mortimer sets great store by social success. She wants Dorothy to marry well." Hannah was silent for a moment, and then burst out, "I'm a Mortimer by marriage only, and Matt's second wife. She's always kept me on the edge of family affairs, and let me know she thinks Matt chose unwisely the second time." Clarissa nodded. She hadn't realized it was quite as bad as that, but she'd sensed some of it. "Tell me." Hannah was slow to start. It was a tale of failure, on her part as well as Dorothy's. She poured more tea for them both, fussed with the biscuits. "Come on," Clarissa urged. "Matt doesn't enjoy the parties his mother gives. What pleasure he gets comes from watching Dorothy enjoy herself. After her first dinner party, he was as proud of her as his mother. Dorothy loved her first dance, and I was as pleased as he was to see she had plenty of partners. A few months later, at another dance, I knew Matt had hardly taken his eyes off her. She seemed to be enjoying herself even more. Full of vitality, she was twirling round the floor in a dress of pale blue satin, laughing up into the face of her partner. 'Who is he?' Matt asked me. 'She's been dancing with him all evening.' 'Lancelin Tolman,' I told him. 'I know him,' Clarissa said. 'Is he Edith Tolman's cousin?' 'Yes, and I introduced them. He seemed a likable fellow, a handsome young army lieutenant in full dress uniform. From the moment Dorothy met him, she had eyes for no one else. Lady Mortimer thought him most unsuitable. It wasn't the Tolman family she objected to. They were well connected. But Lancelin was the youngest of five sons, and his prospects of inheriting anything were nil. He was about to depart with a local regiment on a tour of duty in India. Lady Mortimer said she'd inquired into his character and circumstances, and that he had a terrible reputation. His only interests were women and wild parties, drinking and cards. I tried to tell Matt his mother disliked him because she hadn't chosen him herself. 'If Dorothy loves him,' I said, 'if she truly loves him, she'll be happy, like us.'" Hannah paused. It had roused doubts she hadn't had before. Was Matt happy after all? "Matt and I had our first serious row about Lancelin Tolman. Dorothy couldn't hide her love for him. She was suddenly radiant and bubbling with happiness. Lady Mortimer had already arranged an introduction to Franklin Flower, years older than her, and rather a sober sides. He'd already made one fortune, and had expectations of inheriting another. Mr. Flower had shown considerable interest, but Dorothy laughed and said she found Lancelin Tolman more to her taste. It tore Matt apart to disappoint her. He loved her, and wanted her happiness above everything else, yet his mother convinced him he had to stand firm on this. He explained it as gently as he could to Dorothy. I can see her now, gazing up at him with hurt in her eyes, like an animal at bay. He told her she must forget Tolman for her own good. Then, urged on by his mother, Matt had a totally embarrassing interview with Tolman himself. He forbade him to come anywhere near the house or make further contact with Dorothy. We expected that to be the end of the matter. It wasn't. Dorothy said she couldn't put him out of her mind, that she loved him and he her. Matt had been conditioned to indulge her whims. Dorothy expected to get her way this time. We both knew Tolman was writing to her. We saw the letters arriving with the mail several times a week.
Dorothy acted as though she didn't believe the British Army would insist on Tolman's departure with his regiment. "The war's over now," she said incredulously. "There must be plenty of men who'd like to go in his place." She spoke of an early wedding, as if only the timing was still to be decided. Matt stood firm and said a wedding as important as Dorothy's couldn't be rushed. And until she settled for a more suitable groom, it wasn't going to take place at all. We were all glad to see the regiment leave. I said, "She'll get over it," quite confident that 2 years' separation would solve the problem. But Dorothy continued to mope. The weeks passed, and there was nothing we could do to cheer her up. The change in her was unbelievable. She even talked of travelling to India to marry him out there. "Good Lord," Clarissa commented. Matt was appalled, too. "Dorothy," he said, taking both her hands in his, "you must accept that we'll never give our consent for this marriage." She stared silently back at him in frightened anguish. After that she no longer talked of Tolman, but she didn't pick up. Lady Mortimer was making plans to have her presented at court and do the season, and thought a holiday first might do her good. She goes to Bath every year in the early spring, and suggested we all go with her. Matt got out of it by saying he'd too much work on, but he booked rooms for Dorothy and me. We were to stay for 3 weeks. He said he'd join us for the last few days. Franklin Flower was there, and Lady Mortimer thought meeting him again would take Dorothy's mind off the unfortunate affair. Most mornings we used to meet in the pump room. Hannah swallowed hard. She'd relived this countless times. It was a nightmare. Lady Mortimer liked to take the waters. She thought they did her good. Disgusting taste. One mouthful was enough for me. Dorothy and I had coffee. I was embarrassed to find Edith Tolman in Bath, too, with her mother and sister, though I've always liked her personally. Of course, Dorothy was drawn to them. They were relaying snippets of news about Lancelin, even bringing letters from him for her to read. I warned her to make her interest less obvious when her grandmother was with us. It gave her more reason to blame me, saying they were my friends. Hannah paused. Just to talk about that dreadful day sickened her. Dorothy kept turning round from our table to watch the door. It was as obvious to Eunice as it was to me that she was waiting for the Tolmans to come in. This morning they did not. The string quartet was playing a Strauss waltz when an acquaintance of Eunice Mortimer's paused to speak to her. "Have you heard? Such a tragedy for Mary Tolman. Her son's been killed in India. They're having to return home in a hurry. Packing now, I believe." Dorothy croaked. "Not Lancelin?" "Some skirmish with the natives. He proved himself a hero after all. An honourable death." I couldn't breathe. Couldn't take my eyes from Eunice's face. She actually smiled, clearly thinking it a suitable end for a young man who didn't fit into her plans. The next instant I felt the tablecloth moving beneath my elbow. Dorothy slumped off her chair in a dead faint, dragging it with her. I was too slow to save her. The crash of shattering china drew every eye in the room. Dorothy was lying on the floor in the middle of it, with coffee dregs staining her lavender dress. We were all crunching in the spilled brown sugar. Franklin Flower saw it happen from the doorway. He was just coming in. He was very helpful, calling a cab and seeing us back to our hotel, even helping Dorothy up to her room. I told him she was rather given to swooning, as her chest had always been delicate. Dorothy was cross once we were alone, and said I wasn't to fuss. She wept for the rest of the day. For the next week she refused to eat, and wouldn't leave her room. She spent all day lying on her bed, and all night walking the floor. She looked ill, and seemed to be losing weight. I felt at the end of my tether. It was a relief when Matt said he'd come a day or two earlier than he'd intended. He took one look at the pair of us and called a doctor to prescribe for us both. Matt was dressing after having a bath when the doctor came up to our suite. I took him to Dorothy's room, and he asked me to stay while he examined her. I thought him very young. Gradually, Dorothy's terrible trouble dawned on me from the questions he asked and the very reluctant answers she gave. I didn't want to believe it. The room began to eddy round me, and my legs felt shaky as I followed him out. By then, Matt was hovering on the other side of the door. "What's your diagnosis?" he asked in his bombastic way. "What do you advise to improve Dorothy's health?" "There doesn't seem to be too much the matter. Her pregnancy's progressing normally. Of course, she's in her fifth month and beginning to find it a bit of a trial." I could see Matt shaking, barely able to control himself, impatient then to get rid of the doctor. "It was awful, Clary. I can see the doctor now, the light reflecting off his glasses, soberly advising on the importance of a good diet. Matt bundled him out so fast he never did examine me. I can't understand why I hadn't guessed months earlier." Matt turned on me then in a ferocious rage. "It was your job to chaperone her," he said, his face puce. "But what good was anger when the man was already dead? You neglected your duty. Dorothy is ruined." I went to pieces at the thought of what my mother-in-law would say, and lost my temper. In the middle of this terrible row, there was a knock at the door. Matt was in full flood, too, and we ignored it. It enraged Matt more when the knock came again. He tore across the room and jerked the door open. Franklin Flower was standing in the corridor, nursing a large bouquet. I froze, wondering how long he had been there and how much he might have heard. Matt let his mouth fall open in horror. "Sorry to disturb you at this time of night," our visitor said. "I saw the doctor call and wanted to find out how Dorothy was." "Settled for the night. Sleeping draught." Matt sounded as though he was choking. I managed to say bath didn't suit Dorothy's delicate chest, and that we were returning home early. "Her mother died of TB, you know." "Surely that would worry him." Clarissa's face was aghast. "Not so much as the truth." Next morning, two letters were delivered by special messenger, both from Franklin Flower. One was addressed to Matt, asking formally for Dorothy's hand in marriage. The other was for Dorothy, expressing his love. They brought Matt the first ray of hope. He said if we planned carefully, perhaps Dorothy's reputation could be saved. We must get her away from his mother as soon as possible. Dorothy didn't care one way or the other now, and was persuaded that her best chance of happiness was to fall in with her father's wishes. He dictated Dorothy's acceptance to Franklin Flower, saying I was taking her to Switzerland for a few months, as the doctor recommended, to see if the mountain air would benefit her cough. He even invented a cousin for me living near Geneva, so that it would seem more natural for us to go there. We had such soul-searching about whether we dared tell Gregory. In the end, Matt decided to do so, because he wanted him to go to Geneva to post letters and cards from Dorothy, both to Franklin Flower and her grandparents. Such a complicated tissue of lies, Clary. But for Dorothy's sake, Matt insists we have to go through with it.